Would I have to kill Teresa? Could I even do that? What were my alternatives?
You're not from around here, are you, Inoki?
None of us are, Teresa. She laughed.
You know what I mean. You're not a native, Quinlan. At least not a resident of Heaven's River, like the rest of us. Are you even a Quinlan at all?
What an odd question. What else would I be?
Well, you'd be someone who knows about things like utilitarianism and closest continuous, which I'd never heard of, but not about the three rules which every child learns. And you're someone who thinks the gravity in Heaven's River is 0.86g instead of 1g. Where are you from, that the gravity is 1.16g?
Oh, bugger. I remembered that conversation. I'd assumed the translator would convert my statement, but apparently not. Well, that was just a huge, steaming, smelly pile of... I think you're reading too much into an unconnected series of conversations, Teresa.
That would be a reasonable proposal, except for the thing in your hands. It appears to be metal. If it is, it's enough metal to buy the entire segment. But you're working as a deckhand. One of these things is not like the other. Know what I mean?
She smiled at the last sentence. Teresa rolled her eyes.
You're usually a bit more articulate than that, Inoki. Do you need a slap?
I chortled. No, thanks, Teach. So what are you going to do?
If I tried to call you out, would I survive?
I closed my eyes briefly. That would be the most effective way of dealing with the problem, and from a strictly utilitarian point of view, it might even pass muster, but no. I don't work that way. I'd just run. And I'd have to take a chance on getting this wet. I held up the matrix to illustrate.
So, you are the person they're looking for?
I'm pretty sure. There's always a possibility of coincidence, but I'm going to guess that's unlikely, and even if that turned out to be the case, I'd still end up in the pokey until they straightened it all out.
What are you guilty of?
Trying to rescue a friend. Seriously, Teresa, that's all I'm doing. She nodded.
I believe you. I may be biased, but I don't see someone being able to understand moral philosophy without being guided by it. Besides, you're very interesting to talk to.
I laughed softly and muttered, "Dance, monkey, dance."
What?
It's an ironic statement where I'm from. It means I have to continue to be entertaining in order to preserve my safety.
I hope you won't view me that way, Inoki.
She smiled sadly.
I see no reason to expose you. Tell me this, though. Is wherever you're from outside of Heaven's River? Or at least outside of what the rest of us live in?
I hesitated, then decided to go for it. Yes, Teresa. And you're right, I'm not Quinlan. There is an administrator, but they aren't a deity, just an engineering construct, and they're after me because they want this back. I gestured with the matrix again.
Is it theirs?
I shook my head. No. In fact, I literally, personally built this item myself. The administrator took it from me, then the resistance took it from them, and now I'm trying to take it back. That is enormously simplified and leaves out a lot of detail, but it is the truth. She smiled and nodded.
Thank you for telling me. I will miss our discussions.
What? Why?
Because no doubt you'll be leaving without notice at the first opportunity. Good night, Inoki.
And with that, she turned and headed back to where her granddaughter was curled up. I was shaken. As I finished securing the matrix and placed my spider back into the trunk, I had plenty of time to consider my options. Granted, of all the people to discover me, she was probably the best option, but however I parsed it, I was exposed. And she was right. The safest move might be for me to leave straight away. 90 miles, more or less. That was the surface distance between rivers. I'd briefly considered doing an overland hike to the next river, but that was just too far. 5 days hiking, and that was if nothing went wrong, and again, I couldn't use streams or tributaries. Teresa and Frida were at it again, theistic versus atheistic morality. I'd heard it all so many times before, mostly when I was still alive, that it was hard to stay interested. Teresa glanced at me from time to time, but made no effort to draw me into the conversation. Oryk, however, had no reservations.
"Enoki, what in Father's name is wrong with you? Run out of things to talk about?"
I have things on my mind, Oryk. "Sorry, I'll get over myself soon." Teresa smiled at me.
"It's okay, it's not like we're on a schedule."
I opened my mouth to reply just as the captain started her daily tirade about sloppy, lazy, do-nothing deckhands. Turned out we were on a schedule.
"We'll be turning around at the end of this segment," Ted said during a rest break. "You still planning on continuing east?"
"Yep, as far as I know, they haven't moved my home city."
"Teresa and Belinda are getting off at Misty Falls. That's our last stop before turnaround. I guess you'll all be getting off together."
I thought about that for a moment, but I couldn't see how it affected my level of risk. Teresa wasn't any more likely to suddenly loudly denounce me just because she was on land. Still, once I was on another boat among a whole new set of strangers, I'd feel a lot better. By midday, we were approaching the Misty Falls docks. I couldn't account for the fact that I felt more sadness than a sense of dread or danger, until I realized that I would never see Teresa again. She'd become very much a friend over a surprisingly short time. However, I had no choice. It wasn't even a case of getting away. The hurricane was turning around to head along the Paradise River. Docking was the usual chaotic jumble of yelled orders and flying ropes, and then we were moored. At that point, Captain Lisa came over to say goodbye to Teresa, Belinda, and me. They'd have enough deckhands with Harvey, who was staying on, but no passengers for the return trip. I hoped they'd still be able to turn a profit. I picked up my trunk and followed Belinda and Teresa down the gangplank, not particularly paying attention. Which, I guess, explained my surprise when we walked out into a circle of cops. 19. Recall is a thing. Howard, August 23, 34, Trantor. I sat back and put my hands behind my head, grinning like a fool.
"You have that smug look," Bridget said. "What happened?"
"Well, it turns out we're not the only replicants with money and influence." I waved a hand at the email displayed on the canvas. "Senator McIntosh, remember him? Loudly anti-replicant? He's being recalled."
"Really?"
"They got the required signatures, and guess who was behind the recall campaign?"
"Us?"
I laughed. "No, although I would have loved to have a hand in it. The man is a toxic dump of xenophobia and undirected hate. It's possible he didn't realize that the Afterlife Replicant Reserve is part of his district. Or maybe he thought he could remove our rights before they could fight back, or something." Bridget frowned.
"That would be a couple hundred signatures at most. They'd need..."
Bridget's eyes lost focus for a moment.
"Something like 15,000 to succeed."
"Yep. Turns out, though, that people are concerned about their afterlife." "Afterlives?" "Anyway, the anti-McIntosh group started comparing him to Faith in terms of removing replicant rights, then implied that no matter what kind of post-life setup someone chose, he'd be after them sooner or later. I guess it's different when you're personally threatened." Bridget snorted and sat down beside me. She spent a few seconds paging through the news items before turning to face me.
"Still, he hasn't actually been voted out yet. Let's not count our politicians before they're properly cooked. And the overall problem is still there, mistrust of replicants."
"Which is why I've started a rumor that someone is working on Manny's for the living. It's not exactly spilling the beans. For instance, I didn't share any information about exactly who is doing this or how far along we, they are. But the point is that if humans think they can have a Manny while they're still alive, a full ban will be a hard sell. Bridget smiled noncommittally, then pulled up a new window.
I have an exploration candidate.
I peered at the information on the surface.
Is this new?
Just discovered.
Mario and his crew are still searching for others' nests. They haven't found any, but naturally they're exploring new systems in the process. They've found a few more planets that were hit by the others, and some other planets that hadn't been yet, but probably would have been soon enough. This particular one is... Well, just read it.
I reached across her and paged down through the summary. I could feel a frown forming on my face, then deepening as I continued to read. Is this for real?
Unless Mario has suddenly developed a warped sense of humor, yes. This might turn out to be the weirdest ecosystem I've ever seen, and remember, I've seen Quilt.
I flipped the pages up and down a few times, then grinned at her. Shades of Flash Gordon, this could be fun. Bridget laughed in reply.
I've asked Mario to create us a full space station and autofactory in the system. While he's on that, I'll use his spy drones to get some prelims.
We'll have to do a lot of research on this one. Maybe even more than with the Quinlans.
Wow.
I shook my head in disbelief. Flying monkeys.
Not monkeys. Close enough.
I closed the window. This is going to be your biggest blog subject ever. 20. Moving on. Bob, August 2334, Misty Falls.
We'll need to look in your trunk, sir,
one of the cops said to me. I stood frozen for a second, trying to decide if I should make a break for it. Teresa's voice cut through the silence.
Why in particular would you need to see the contents of my trunk, officer?
He turned to her, surprise on his face.
Your trunk?
She gave him an arch look.
Do I look like I can carry that thing around on my own? I've paid him 2 coppers to porter for me. If you keep us too long, the captain will have to delay departure.
And you are?
I am Teresa Sikorsky, late of the University of Peachland.
The cop stepped back, abashed, and I couldn't blame him. This was the first I'd heard that Teresa had a family name, and a well-known one, apparently. That she hadn't thrown it in Snidely's face showed an amazing level of restraint. But meanwhile, the cops were almost falling over themselves trying to placate her. She gave them a sniff and gestured imperiously for me to follow. As we marched away, I muttered to her, "You could have left him some fur." She laughed and stopped.
Let that be my parting gift to you, Inoki. I hope I might someday learn more of your world, and of my world, for that matter. Goodbye.
I said goodbye and headed quickly down the nearest street, trying not to choke up. I had a whole 6 irons in pay from my time on the hurricane. With the 2 still in my stomach, I was a wealthy man. Okay, not man, Quinlan. Okay, not wealthy, either. I could survive for a few days if I had to pay for a hotel. Like it or not, I was going to have to get back on a boat quickly. But I couldn't go back to the dock now. The cops would certainly remember me and the trunk. I could change my appearance, but not the trunk. Or could I? I tried to remember where the shipping office was. I'd seen it out of the corner of my eye as we left the port area. Quickly, I played back the video archive until I found it. I headed back toward the dock, taking the long way around so that the shipping office would be between me and the cops, assuming they were still maintaining watch. On the way, I gradually changed my appearance, using features from random pedestrians to produce a mashup that shouldn't resemble any one individual. I just hoped I was getting it right. I couldn't take out my spider to get a selfie. If people screamed and turned away, I'd have to start over. As hoped, the shipping office sold shipping containers. At 1 iron apiece, they weren't expensive or high quality, but the idea wasn't high security. It was to hide the contents. A row of eyelets around the lid allowed the user to essentially tie it shut, as with a shoelace. It was good enough. The clerk wanted to sell me postage as well, but I initially demurred since I would be traveling with the package. Still, it was probably better to do things the normal way. Finally, I paid the 3 irons, then filled in the tag with just my name and Garrick's spine. But I insisted that I would deliver the box to an appropriate boat.
"Knock yourself out," he said, holding up his hands in mock surrender.
I headed back to the dock, shipping container held awkwardly in both hands, and stopped at the dockmaster's office. "Good day, sir," I said to the person at the counter. "Could you tell me if any ships heading downriver are looking for deckhands?" Counter guy glanced at the container in my hands with a frown.
Deckhands? Or postal run?"
"Both. I have a package that I have to send downriver as well. Killing 2 fish with 1 spear. Doesn't have to be the same boat." He nodded, satisfied, and gave me a couple of names. Explanation notwithstanding, I wasn't going to put Bender on a different vessel. I had to hope the boat looking for help would also take an extra shipping container. I thanked him and headed for the indicated berth. The Clipper was somewhat less barge-like than the Hurricane had been. It even had a below-deck area fit for habitation, if you didn't mind crouching a little. It also appeared to be in a state of chaos. People were running around while the captain screamed orders with the same volume and enthusiasm as Lisa's best work. I watched for about 5 seconds, simply absorbing the frenetic energy. I waved at one of the deckhands, and he slowed down to acknowledge me but didn't come to a complete stop. Definitely stressed, I walked along with him. "I was told you need a deckhand."
"You think? What's the box?"
"A parcel. I've paid postage."
"Whatever. Put it with the postage items on deck. Standard pay. See that pile of crates? Goes over there. Get to work."
I was left opening and closing my mouth for a moment, wondering when I'd get to present my sales pitch. Reluctantly accepting victory, I placed my box in the postal pile, then jumped to work, grabbing boxes and lugging them up the gangplank. They were heavy, and there were a lot of them, but the manny was more than up to the task. I had to dive into the water twice to cool off, but everyone else was doing the same, as usual. In short order, I had the pallet moved. "Next," I said to the same deckhand, who turned out to be the foreman. With a pleased expression, he pointed to another pile of boxes. About 2 hours later, it began to look like we were catching up. I did a quick cooling dunk, then joined the other deckhands. The foreman slapped me on the shoulder.
"Good work. I hope you can keep up that level of energy. It looks like we're going to be short-handed."
"Why's that?" I asked.
"Cops came by and arrested 2 of our crew for no reason I could see. Took their personal effects, too. It's supposed to be just for one night, but we can't wait. We have performance clauses on this shipment, so we're leaving by dusk if the captain has to row the boat himself."
"Which explains why he seemed excited," I replied. Foreman guy laughed.
"Yeah, excited. That's what we call it. He used some threats I've never heard before. I think he was saving them for today."
I grinned. "I'm Sam Oops, I almost gave myself a last name again. Nope, didn't need the notoriety." My faux pas didn't register, though, or maybe the translation software hadn't passed it on. The foreman, whose name was Ralph, introduced the team just as the captain started up with another tirade.
"Time to cast off, people,"
Ralph said, rolling his eyes in the captain's direction. We got back to work, aided by more of the captain's helpful suggestions. I did notice that those suggestions tended to be anatomically related. This guy ran a theme, I guess. The duties on the Clipper were generally the same as on the Hurricane, with a few extra tweaks since it was a bigger boat and a full-on catamaran design. We moved a few items below decks on Ralph's orders and checked the sails once more, and we were done, until the next time the captain's head exploded. I'd almost tripped on several occasions over a quartet of Quinlans who had parked their butts in the middle of the deck. A few choice words from Ralph and they found a more out-of-the-way location. Now that I had the time to actually look at them, I realized they were probably a sabbat. It was odd that they'd be paying for passage when we weren't going through a connector or segment boundary. where the turbulence could get uncomfortable and tiring to fight. "Hi, all," I said, holding up a hand. "I'm Sam, lately out of a sabbat myself. We just went our own ways a couple of weeks ago."
"Hello, Sam," replied one of the group. "I'm Tina, and these are Fred, Tony, and Barb. We're looking to homestead. We'll be jumping as soon as we see a good spot."
"Starting your own town?"
"Nothing so ambitious. We want to get away from towns altogether. Don't need them. The fishing is good. This isn't one of the cold segments, and a nest is easier to make and maintain. And we won't have to worry about the juniors getting into trouble."
"So you're going back to the wild?"
"Pretty much. Don't need the rest of it, counting irons to see if you're ahead, you know?"
"Yeah," I replied. "I do, kind of. You aren't the first group I've run into that's doing this, either." She smiled in reply, and I glanced at the other three. None of them seemed inclined to chime in. It was unsettling. This was an intelligent species devolving almost right in front of my eyes. Tina and I talked about inconsequential things for a bit until Tony suddenly declared, "Food time," and slipped over the edge of the boat. The others joined him, Tina giving me an apologetic shrug before leaving. I settled myself on the deck to get a bit of sun, following the sailor's tradition of resting whenever possible. A couple of the other deckhands joined me after glancing at the captain, who was ignoring us for the moment. A few minutes later, the members of the sabbat pooted onto the deck and settled down with their catch. It was a comfortable, drowsy, idyllic interlude, something I hadn't gotten anywhere near enough of since the Starfleet issue started. If I'd still been bio, I'd have drifted off to sleep. Some of my co-workers seemed to be doing exactly that. Tina had mentioned cold segments. That was interesting. Tina, have you ever been in a cold segment?
No, but my dad lived in one for a while. It snowed sometimes, and there was ice on some of the streams. I've never seen snow or ice. Hard water, right? Weird. Different fish, too, and some other plants and animals that are different.
She thought for a moment.
Dai used to tell stories of segments that had other oddities as well. There was supposed to be one that was mostly water, with only islands sticking up here and there. Another one was dry, and the river actually disappeared under the land. I don't know how much to believe, and how much with Dai trying to scare us when we were juniors.
I don't think your Dai was making it up, Ralph volunteered. I've heard of segments with different climates. They always have different plant and animal life. Whether the plants and animals came first or the different climate came first, I don't know.
I started to wish I'd paid more attention to Bridget's conversations with Quinlan's and the theories she'd discussed. This had the feel of a discussion of evolution based on the mistaken idea that Heaven's River was a natural environment, and deism was replacing history in regard to the administrator. Top that off with the back-to-nature movement and a possible loss of sapience, and the Quinlans were in peril of ceasing to exist as an intelligent species, possibly within as little as a few more generations. Was it time for the Bob to get involved? Did I dare start stirring the pot again? Was it a good idea while I was still in-country and vulnerable? I could just blow up the Manny and return to Vert if I got in trouble, but Bender didn't have that option. I'd finally managed to get everyone together for a meeting. Hugh was parked in Will's beanbag chair, but the rest of the expedition members were present in floating video windows. I'd just finished describing the latest conversation with fellow deckhands and passengers.
I think you're correct, Bob. It's going that way, although maybe not as quickly as you fear.
Bridget crossed her arms, a distinctly worried expression on her face, which clashed with her mildly reassuring phrasing.
I don't know if it matters, Hugh replied. How long it'll take, I mean. The takeaway is that it will happen if nothing changes. I don't think we can refuse to deal with this.
I gazed at him, head cocked. I still hadn't had a chance to bring up the whole question of the administrator's true status and Hugh's true motivations. How would he play this? And how would you suggest we do that? Will asked.
Contact the administrator. Talk to them. They may not realize what's happening.
Maybe once Bender is safe, I said. Not until. That's not negotiable. And anyway, what makes you think they don't know? Hugh's brows knit together as he glanced at me.
Seriously?
You think they'd want that?
Depends on what the administrator's motivations are. Maybe they'd consider a non-sentient but living Quinlan race better than a sentient but always on the edge of extinction version. Like a perverse instantiation, you know? Now Hugh was all but glaring at me, his eyes narrowed. At that moment, I think we understood each other. I might have just blown any element of surprise, but on the other hand, it might force a reaction of some kind. It seemed a worthwhile trade-off. Certainly there's no reason not to try, Bill spoke into the silence. Once Bender is safe, as you say, we can just start broadcasting radio from all our drones, or send in a spider to dance in front of a camera. Either they'll investigate and open a dialogue, or they'll blow up our devices. We'll know better once they've set the tone.
And what if they do blow up our roamer or whatever device?
Bridget said, her voice tense.
Do we just walk away? Do we just let an entire intelligent species go? Can we ethically do that?
Starfleet would. I glared at Garfield. They're not really a moral standard to hold up right now, Gar. I meant Star Trek's Starfleet, not the current crop of idiots we're dealing with. Oh, I nodded. True, but even then, original Bob always thought that was a bunch of dreck.
Focus, please,
Bridget cut in.
This isn't a Comic-Con. We're discussing the fate of an actual intelligent species.
Bill smirked at her. Okay, look, we won't invade or anything, but we won't just go away either. We'll keep poking until we can get a statement from the administrator. If they tell us they have everything under control and we should go away, do we really have a right to butt in? I rubbed the bridge of my nose and sighed loudly.
It always comes down to this, doesn't it?
Edge cases, gray areas. I agree with Bill, at least on the basics. We can't decide now, and we can't decide until we contact the administrator. I glared at Hugh, which we won't do until Bender is out of danger. I re-entered my Manny on the clipper just as the crew was starting to stir for the morning shift. Ralph assigned a deckhand named Gil and me to gathering breakfast, and I happily dove into the water with a small net. There was never a lack of any of the Quinlan's several favorite prey species. Careful balancing of the ecosystem by the administrator, or just a case of too few predators? I mused over the question as I gathered breakfast. I pooted onto the deck just seconds before Gil, but I noticed that his bag was fuller. Most likely he intended to eat the overage. Gil was known for his appetite. The captain grabbed a few fish for himself, then the rest of us sat around the fishbowl. I ate the minimum that I could get away with without arousing suspicion, interspersing my meal with a lot of conversation. Tina and her friends were more than willing to talk about their views on the world. Well, Tina, mostly. The others nodded a lot. During a lull in the conversation, Ralph looked up and said,
"Well, that's weird."
I followed his pointing finger to see a small bird equivalent perched on top of a pallet of crates.
"That's a furl. They're forest birds. What's it doing out here on the river?"
"Lost," I ventured. Ralph shook his head.
"I don't..."
At that moment, the birds, seemingly embarrassed by all the attention, flew off. He shook his head again, and conversation drifted to other topics. I would have dismissed the matter as inconsequential, except that I'd seen that species of bird around on the boat a couple of times. I'd just assumed it was looking for food scraps, but Ralph's bemusement had me paranoid. I scraped a few bits of fish from my current helping and set them aside. When we were done with breakfast and the captain had started ramping up his morning delivery of abuse, I took a moment and placed the food scraps on top of the crate where the bird had perched. Life on a Quinlan boat was very much a panic and boredom thing. When in port, we worked until we dropped, whereas while en route, tasks tended to be routine and easy, if somewhat dull. This left me multiple opportunities to keep my eye on the food offering. The furl buzzed the boat twice more but showed no interest in the scraps. A couple of ackrels, though, descended on it with cries of noisy delight. So maybe furl were herbivores? I might be overgeneralizing from Terran examples, but birds tended to be opportunistic feeders. Even hummingbirds ate insects when available. I sighed silently and grabbed the net to retrieve the afternoon meal. I felt a little silly getting bent out of shape over a bird. Ralph had been convincing, but still. Mealtime conversations were always freewheeling, but hadn't been nearly as interesting since Teresa and I had parted ways. I often found my mind drifting while the others argued the fine points of Quinlan life. Bridget would probably be very interested, and in fact might be replaying the sessions as fast as they could be transferred across the Scut connection. I snapped back to attention, though, when Gil said,
"Hey, Sam, your pet is back."
Sure enough, a furl was hopping around on the pile of crates. I scraped off a bit of fish and tossed it in the right direction. The furl froze for a moment, then went back to hopping around, completely ignoring the offering. In fact, it appeared to be reading labels? That couldn't be right. I turned back to my companions, but kept one eye on the animal. It eventually left the pallet and flew over to another stack and repeated the performance. And the more I watched it, the more convinced I became that it was looking at the shipping information on the crates. I contacted Hugh on the intercom. "Hey, Hugh. What's up, Bob? Do we know if the administrator's technology level is advanced enough to include small, drone-like units?" "Unlikely. No surge drive. What about something that emulates a bird?" Ornithopter kind of thing? Yeah, I don't see why not. The Boojums were masterpieces of miniaturization. You said so yourself. Yeah. You're on a boat, right? Have you seen any small birds hanging around? Lots of ackerels. Rats with wings they are, but nothing else. Let me know if you spot any furls, okay? Will do. Hugh sounded a little puzzled as he signed off, although whether that was because of the request or the fact that I hadn't confronted him on the AI issue was anyone's guess. Meanwhile, the furl had finished investigating a third stack and was back to the miscellaneous pile, which included my crate. Paranoia was no longer a valid explanation. As soon as we settled down for the night, I went back to Vert and called Bill. He showed up in a video window right away. "What's up, Bob?" I explained about the furl's behavior, then asked him about Quinlan drones. "I agree with Hugh about the lack of surge being a limiting factor, but there's no reason why the administrator couldn't have security devices that mimic birds. Even in original Bob's day, they had mechanical devices that could emulate bird flight, and the administrator has had generations to work on it, and no real alternative." "But why the Clipper?" "I've been careful to avoid any connection with previous me. The backpack's put away, Bender's not visible, I look different. What could have tipped it off?" "You don't know that it has been tipped off, Bob. Think of how the CDC would track down disease spread. Lots of detective work, mapping of contacts, logical extrapolation, and so on. They can't find Bob with a bulky backpack anywhere, so it's logical to assume you've either gone into hiding or found a different way to get around. They know where you left the infrastructure because they have a failed use of Natasha's card. From there, it's just a case of working outward, and given Quinlan limitations and the geography of Heaven's River, they can concentrate mostly on east and west." I nodded, thinking it through. "And river travel is the obvious method. No doubt they're watching for Quinlan's swimming in a directed manner as well. They can't know for sure that I won't risk submerging Bender."
"Which is probably splitting their efforts," Bill replied. "Good for us, but shipping the Matrix is an obvious ploy, if you think of it. They could board and inspect every crate of every ship in two segments, but I imagine they simply don't have the personnel for that."
"So maybe they'll be looking for anything even the slightest bit odd, like the lack of detail on my shipping label, and maybe the shipping guy remembered me wanting to travel with my crate."
"Uh-huh.
They'll be watching for anything even a little off. Even if it doesn't pan out, it applies pressure."
"Yeah, you're right. And they'll keep adding tactics for as long as they aren't successful."
I shook my head at Bill and sighed deeply. "Looks like I'm right back in the fertilizer." We coasted up to the dock in the town of Six Hills. No one knew why it was called Six Hills. You could only get four hills from the surrounding territory, and only that if you were generous with the interpretation of the word hill. By this point, though, I just rolled my eyes at Quinlan naming conventions. Maybe there was a
subtle sort of irony involved, like naming a large man Tiny. If so, I hadn't caught on yet. There were cops waiting on the dock as we pulled up, which was perplexing to everyone except me. As soon as the gangplank was down, the gendarmerie marched up straight to the postal pile and grabbed the crate with just my name on the label, which wasn't actually my crate, as I'd swapped labels with another crate the night before, and rearranged the stack just in case their instructions were very specific. I felt a bit bad that someone in Little Creek wasn't going to get their shipment, but there wasn't much in the way of alternatives. The cop read the label, then said loudly,
"Which of you is Sam?"
I raised my hand and stepped forward.
"You're going to have to come with us."
I feigned surprise and displeasure. My acting was reinforced by the very real surprise and displeasure expressed by the captain and crew. I was a hard worker and therefore popular.
"Sorry, folks, but we need to have a talk with this person at the station. I'm sure you'll be able to find a new crew member quickly."
Uh-oh. I'd been expecting something like the scenario with Snidely. Open the box, nothing there, sorry to bother you, etc. "Excuse me," I said. "How long exactly is this interview supposed to take?"
"Could be a couple of days, Sam. The officials will be coming in from another city."
But, oh, this was ungood. If it had just been overnight, worst case, the captain probably would have waited. We didn't have a deadline for anything that was on board at the moment, and the cargo we were contracted to pick up was all non-perishable. But the captain wouldn't wait days, especially some unknown number of days. Time was money for a riverboat. The captain came over to me.
"I'd be sorry to see the last of you, Sam. You're an exceptionally good worker and not much of a complainer. Here's what I owe you to this point."
He handed me some coins, which I pocketed. The subtext was crystal clear. The Clipper would be leaving as soon as they got their cargo squared away. The cop was polite and waited until I'd said my goodbyes and grabbed my backpack, then led me off the dock and into town. Behind us, another cop carried the shipping crate. "What's going on? What are you looking for?" I asked. He gazed at me for a moment, maybe trying to decide how much to tell me.
"I don't have much of anything for you, Sam. We were given the name of the boat, the name on the label to look for, and orders to take both you and the box to the station, pending a visit. I don't even know who is coming."
He leaned in close.
"But the scuttlebutt is that it's crew."
"Crew? Aren't they a myth?" The cop smiled at my apparent naivety.
"I know a lot of people think that, Sam, but law enforcement has to work with them occasionally. We know they're real. Some of them have weapons."
He mimed holding a gun and firing it.
"That can put you to sleep from a distance. I've seen them."
Oh, boy. So I was to be held for some number of days until crew could come and examine me. This was well past ungood, heading for double plus. 21. Earth Abides. Bill, September 2334, Vert, Earth. I pinged Charles and received an invitation to drop in. I was surprised by his VR. It appeared to be the hotel suite that original Bob was staying in on the day he died. I couldn't keep a perplexed expression off my face. Charles laughed. "I know, Bill. It's been called everything from morbid to macabre, but it grounds me somehow. Reminds me where we all came from, you know?" "Yeah, okay, at least you're still trying. Most VRs I visit these days are just Bob One's default library theme." I invoked a lazy boy, sat, and accepted a coffee from Jeeves. "So, to what do I owe the pleasure?" Charles asked. I replied with a helpless shrug. "I've been popping around everywhere, evaluating damage from the Starfleet attack. I guess I just wanted to take a break in a location that I already know isn't affected." Charles nodded slowly. "I'm still not sure if we were just lucky or if they left us alone out of some kind of respect." He gestured to his picture window where Earth hung in the heavens. Or maybe we're just irrelevant. I was sure Charles was just trolling me. No Bob would think that about the Earth Rehabilitation Project. Of course, there was some question about whether Starfleet could be considered Bob's anymore. Charles, you've been one of the more prolific cloners. Do you have any kind of feeling about whether Starfleet's last common ancestor was of your line? Charles shook his head. I can't contact all my clones, but none of those who I've talked to can identify a candidate. And I'm going 15, 16 generations down. The ones you can't contact are out of range, either temporarily until they build a station or indefinitely because they aren't bothering. I sighed and tasted my coffee while I considered the possibilities. Pretty much everyone in the first couple of generations says the same. We all have descendants who've gone dark that way, so it's not specifically a drift thing. Something in original Bob, maybe a tendency to run away. I don't know. I think you're overanalyzing it, Bill. Drift is drift.
You're going to get convergent evolution as well.
Same end behavior from different lines, I suppose. To change the subject, I gestured at the image of Earth. How's it going?
Pretty good.
We've halted the Ice Age, and the glaciers are starting to retreat. We're taking it really slow, of course. We don't want to overdo it with the warming. We've already shut down three mirrors. Current estimates are that we'll be back to an interglacial in another 100 years. That's fast, geologically speaking. Any luck with DNA sampling? I've got a fleet of drones doing nothing but scanning for carcasses. Between the Svalbard Library and our efforts, we've probably got complete DNA for 80% of species, not counting insects. I get that those are harder, but what about museums and universities? They've always had huge bug collections. Yeah, working on that angle, too. Charles gazed at me for a few mils, head cocked slightly. So getting back on topic, Bill, I gotta say you seem sort of morose these days. Is it the Starfleet thing or something else?
Starfleet's part of it.
I guess I'm just disappointed with the way things are evolving. We had a pretty good thing going for a while. Everyone was pulling in the same direction. Humanity was finally getting their collective shit together. And a post-scarcity utopian civilization was looking like an achievable goal. Even a couple of alien species to make the UFS title something other than ironic. Now, pfft, gone. Charles took a deep breath and let it out slowly.
I don't think it's gone, Bill.
But things go in cycles, you know? We all pulled together for the war against the others, and that felt good. Now everyone's doing their own thing. The trouble with being immortal is you're living long enough now to see these things come and go. Just wait 100 years or so, and I bet it'll come around again. I laughed, then stood and put my cup down on a side table. Yeah, you're right. I guess I need to get some of that perspective. I gestured to the image of Earth with my chin. There's a good chance we'll have the tensor field printers perfected by the time you're ready to repopulate the planet. Then we'll be able to literally print living cells. Good. I'd like to see it brought back to the way it was before. We'd all like that, Charles. See ya. 22. Another close call. Bob, September 2334, Six Hills. They placed me in an actual cell, with two buckets and a mattress on the floor. One bucket contained water, the other was empty, except for some stains from previous occupants that left little doubt about the intended use.
Yuck!
The bars were something that resembled bamboo, and they felt solid. They were also embedded firmly into the floor and ceiling. A small window high on the wall let air and light in. There were two cells against one wall of the room, with a door on the opposite wall that led to the rest of the station. The cop took my backpack after inventorying the contents and giving me a receipt, which he placed in the backpack. I wasn't sure if that was deliberate irony, but commenting wouldn't accomplish anything except possibly pissing them off, so I kept a cork in it. After announcing the dinner would be at dusk, they left me to my own devices, which normally would be just an expression, except, you know, Bob. I had no spiders left, my last spider being in the crate with Bender, but I did have a couple of fleas. They might or might not be able to cut the bamboo without starting a fire. I was just going to have to take the chance. I'd have loved to do a little spying and get the lay of the land jail-wise, but fleas didn't have sufficient audio-visual capability. While the fleas examined the structure of the bars, I sat down and engaged in a good old-fashioned panic attack. Bender was sailing off with the clipper with a postal address in three circles. Some unlucky recipient was going to get a face full of angry spider instead of whatever was in the box that the cops currently had in their possession. Either the recipient would report the issue to the authorities, in which case Bender would be back in the hands of either the resistance or the administrator, or the recipient would try to break down the cube for metal. Whether or not they were ultimately successful, Bender wouldn't survive the treatment. I looked out the window to see the sky fading to dusk. The clipper would have left by now. They'd get out to the middle of the river before dusk and sail all night, putting on up to 100 miles per day. Sailing in Heaven's River was an almost mindless activity since you always had the current on your side. The wind tended to be north-south due to residual Coriolis forces, so boats could use a beam reach to travel even faster than the river current. I wasn't sure if my Manny could overtake them, even swimming flat out. The fleas reported in. The bars were embedded in holes in the ceiling and floor sills, 4 inches deep at each end. There was about an inch of free play at the top, no doubt to allow for expansion. I tested the bars, attempting to bend them in various directions. No joy. There was no chance I'd be able to pull them out of their settings. However, I could rotate the bars, which meant they weren't cemented or nailed in. I had the fleas pull out their plasma cutters and do a test cut in the bottom setting. There was some smoke and a burning smell, but no actual flames. Good. They'd have to work slowly to keep the smoke and odor to a minimum, which would drive me crazy, but this wasn't the time to get caught because of impatience. And of course, the cops picked this very moment to deliver dinner. Oh, look, fish, yum. The cop sniffed the air and got a concerned expression. I shrugged and pointed at the window. Yeah, you should smell it from in here. I think someone's burning garbage. He glanced at the window, shrugged, and opened the cell door long enough to hand me the bowl. I briefly considered jumping him. I could have taken him on, and easily. But I had no idea how many more cops were waiting in the general staff area. On the other hand, now that dinner was delivered, I very likely had total privacy until morning. The fleas cut a crenellation pattern on one of the bars just below the sill level. Seated one way, the bar would sit normally. Turned 60 degrees, the bar would sit 3 inches higher. I then had the fleas go into the top sill and cut the bar down to just above sill level. They dropped pieces into the hollow interior of the bar as they cut it down. Now I had a bar that I could pull out with just a slight bend, then put back in the sill and rotate to make it appear to be solidly seated. For phase two, I started modifying my appearance to match the cop who had escorted me here. Hopefully he was day shift and would have gone home by the time I was ready to bust out, and if someone spotted me, they wouldn't notice that I wasn't wearing the police accoutrements. Oh, who was I kidding? This wasn't a plan. It was a desperation move. Most likely, I'd end up having to fight my way out and play the lead in a chase to the river. I recalled the fleas, swallowed them, and twisted the bar. As expected, it came out easily, leaving me a tight but passable gap to squeeze through. I replaced the bar behind me, then crept to the door and put my ear to it. The general office area on the other side of the door had a couple of desks, a front counter, and some back rooms. There had been 4 cops, including my escort, when I was incarcerated, but now it was night, and I hoped the night shift would be smaller, maybe even a single person. I cracked the door and slowly pulled it open, peering through the gap. I had about a 30-degree view of the office area. Empty. Oddly, that was more worrying than reassuring. There would certainly be at least 1 person, and I had no idea where that person was. I quickly pulled the door open a little further and stuck my head out for a fraction of a second and took a panoramic snapshot. As I began carefully pushing the door closed, I took the time to examine the image. Two cops. Damn. But in one of those Murphy moments, the door that had moved so silently for me when I opened it quickly squeaked as I slowly closed it. "Are you freaking kidding me?" I muttered. A voice from the office said,
"What was that?"
And another replied,
"It came from the cells."
Then the first voice again,
"I'll check if there's a problem."
Great. They'd undoubtedly turned to look at the door, so I couldn't move it any further. In particular, I couldn't re-latch it. I left the door slightly ajar and moved to stand behind it. Standard cliche move, but I knew I could react faster than the cop. He came into the room cautiously, but the kind of caution where you don't actually believe you're in danger. His loss, my gain. As soon as he was past the door, I swatted him on the side of the head. By this point, I'd swatted so many Quinlans that I had the strike finally calibrated. I caught him as he crumpled. If I'd had the time, I would have modified my features to match his, but I only had a few seconds before the second cop would get suspicious and come in with short sword drawn. I pulled the door open, careful not to show my face, and said, using the unconscious cop's voice from a few seconds ago, "There's a problem." The other cop came into the room, and bam, down he went. It was the work of a few moments to take the keys, place both cops in the cell, and lock them up. Hopefully they wouldn't test the bars, or they'd be out of jail quickly, but I simply didn't have time to tie up all the loose ends. I had to be gone before they regained their senses, as they might start up a hue and cry that would bring help in short order. Placing the keys on one of the desks, I grabbed my backpack from where I'd seen the cops store it and sauntered out of the constabulary as nonchalant as you please, not quite whistling a jaunty tune. As soon as I was around a corner, I cut in the afterburners and made for the river. I took a quick glance at the boats still at dock to verify that the Clipper was gone, then dove into the river. The ideal depth for speed swimming was about a foot down, not so close to the water's surface that I caused cavitation, but close enough that the water I was displacing could easily bulge upward to get out of my way. I would have to surface every mile or so to look for the running lights of boats in the area, and I'd have to check out each one until I found the Clipper. The Manny could probably keep up a maximum pace for 6 hours before I'd have to stop to do a maintenance check. Chances were that the check would reveal nothing and I could continue on. Overheating wouldn't be a problem in the water as long as all systems continued to operate properly. These and other thoughts echoed through my brain as I drove the Manny eastward. Another problem I would have trouble with would be explaining how I caught up with them. Not just caught up with them so fast, but caught up with them at all. A Bio Quinlan wouldn't have been able to maintain the necessary pace. This stretch of the river was busy. I checked close to a half dozen boats before dawn. It didn't require much finesse. Very few boats adhered to a standard design, and even boats built by the same shipyard would have incremental changes on every new build. If that wasn't enough, the sails were quite often individualized, although that wasn't much use at night. Once dawn broke, I could use telescopic vision to check boats from a greater distance. Very few required me to even change course. And finally, I spotted the Clipper, cruising along near dead center on the river. Now, how was I going to explain my reappearance? I swam parallel to the boat for a while, formulating and discarding increasingly wild scenarios. Then I had an idea. It wasn't a great idea. It wasn't even a good one, but it would get me on the boat. I looked around, gauging the traffic levels and the likelihood of my wake being spotted. For safety, I decided to swim slightly deeper for this sprint. I submerged and poured on the horses, passing the Clipper, by dead reckoning, a few hundred yards to port. When I estimated that I was far enough ahead of them, I popped up onto the surface and began to float, otter style. While I waited, I adjusted my features so that I wasn't a close twin for the cop that had hauled Sam away. It would be just my luck for someone to remember the guy's mug. Within minutes, the Clipper was bearing down on me. I waved, waited until I got an acknowledgement from someone on deck, then swam over and pooted on board right in front of Ralph. "Hi," I said in the cop's voice that I'd used most recently. "I'm Wyatt. I've been swimming for days and I'm ready for a change of pace. I can pay for passage or I can work if you have an opening."
You're in luck, he replied. We lost a crew member back in Six Hills. Standard rate.
He examined me from several angles.
No luggage or anything?
I travel light, I said, patting my backpack. I settled back into life on the Clipper, being careful to be a good worker but not as good as Sam. I was also careful not to use people's names before I was introduced. I hadn't engaged with this group all that much, so I didn't have a lot of subjects to remember to avoid. This time around, I was determined to be even less sociable. I tried to project affable loner whenever someone talked to me. Not impolite by any means, but no attempt to keep the conversation going. I would try for neither likable nor unlikable, but forgettable. It turned out to be easier than expected. The days of arguing and debating with Teresa on the hurricane had been idyllic, even with the stress of my situation, and the crew of this boat seemed flat and uninteresting by comparison. My package was in the same spot, wearing the same label, as verified by a brief conversation with my spider. I thought about finding a blank label and relabeling the box, but I knew that Ralph maintained a manifest and would notice if one destination disappeared and another mysteriously replaced it. Little Creek was in the next segment, and the Clipper would be turning around at the end of this one to head back up along the Arcadia River. That meant they would be offloading any postal items intended for a downstream destination at the last town in this segment, which was High Ridge. I was playing around with a number of scenarios for grabbing the box, either during offloading or afterward, but nothing had gelled yet. On my third day as Wyatt, we were eating lunch when Ralph pointed and said,
"More ferals."
I turned to look, and sure enough, a couple of the small birds were hopping around on the cargo.
"There must be food in one of those crates," he continued. "I've never seen birds so interested in cargo, not even ackerels. And those garbage scows will eat wood if nothing else is available."
Hugh hadn't mentioned any birds acting unusual yet in his location. Maybe the search hadn't widened to that point yet, but the administrator was definitely on full alert, judging from the activity here. I did a quick calculation, then contacted Hugh. "Hey, Hugh, I think you should start seeing ferals or other birds acting funny in the next 2 days or so."
Because
the theoretical search perimeter will have expanded to your location by that point.
Makes sense, but the administrator probably will try something else soon, Bob. They're not going to just stick with random searches.
Yeah. We'll deal with that when we come to it, I guess. And who knew what form that something else would take? With the fake birds still checking postal items, I couldn't pull any fast ones with labels. The administrator was probably checking boxes against the postal manifests. Come to think of it, uh-oh. My manner of leaving the Six Hills jailhouse would have been attention-getting, to say the least. By now, they'd have opened the shipping crate and discovered its mundane contents. It wouldn't be much of a stretch to figure out that I had switched crates or labels. They'd be after the Clipper. Normally, that wouldn't be a problem, since the fastest form of transport for information or goods was a boat. But the administrator, and for that matter, the Resistance, had already long since proven that they weren't limited by what was available to the public. There would be a welcome party waiting at High Ridge, and they'd be armed to the teeth. Come to think of it, they didn't even have to wait at High Ridge. They could sail out from the next town and board us. Things had just gotten even more complicated. I had called an emergency expedition meeting, and Bill, Will, and Bridget were attending by video window. Hugh sat in the beanbag chair, as was becoming common. Bill stared into space, his coffee forgotten.
"You could grab the box and slip over the side as soon as it gets dark."
"And go where?" I replied. "Granted, the crates float, but I can't pull it underwater. It's too buoyant, and it probably wouldn't be watertight enough for that kind of treatment. If I just push it along the surface, it'll take forever, and someone will notice. That's not normal behavior."
"And if he tries to go inland, it's likely that there will be surveillance birds. That's an obvious thing to watch for,"
Bridget added. Will glanced in my direction before replying. "And I think Bob's right about a boarding party being likely. That's certainly what I would do. They don't seem to have anything like constitutional protections in Heaven's River. What the cops say they will do, they can do. Bridget nodded.
But they still have to tread carefully, because if they make the citizens mad, there will be a revolt. Quinlans appear to be very hard to intimidate, even by authority figures.
So I can't leave the boat, and I can't stay on the boat. I frowned. That does limit my choices. Hugh grinned at me.
Oh, you can leave or stay, no problem. It's Bender they're looking for.
No, I think they want Bob too, Bridget said. He's part of the mystery, and not just because of his apparent superhuman abilities.
And you can't just change the labels again. I don't think it would matter anyway, Bill, at this point. My guess is they'll open every single crate. Like I said, it's what I'd do.
What about hiding Bender somewhere else on the boat?
Bridget asked. Will shook his head. If it was me, I'd do a thorough search, even underwater. Even in the bilge, in case anyone was going to suggest that. I sat forward. That's it, then. Staying on the boat is out of the question. I'll have to take my chances with the wilderness of the river.
I'd suggest wilderness, Bridget replied. You have more speed advantage there, and it is possible that the searchers won't consider it a likely alternative, or at least they'll be reluctant to pursue it. Quinlans don't like being too far from water.
I nodded. It would appear I was going on a hike. I took the night watch for one of the other workers in return for a favor that I would never collect on. As soon as breathing sounds indicated that everyone was peacefully asleep, I snuck over to the postal pile. I'd accidentally restacked everything earlier in the day so that my crate was easily accessible. Now I took it and slipped as silently as possible over the side. I balanced the crate on my stomach and sculled away from the clipper, using only my tail to prevent any disturbance on the water's surface. Thanks to the Quinlan design, I could easily watch where I was going, but I was reluctant to place the crate in the water, so the trip to shore took a solid hour. I could see some lights downriver that were likely the next town. I hadn't bothered to find out its name, as we were not scheduled to stop there. I felt bad for the crew of the clipper, who had all been good people, even the volatile captain. The guy who traded shifts with me would certainly not fare well, and when the cops arrived, they'd have to mention me jumping ship or they'd have no excuse for the missing crate. Dawn was just starting to come to the eastern sky as I crawled up out of the water into the shoreline weeds. I could make a nest in the tall greenery, but I'd have to make sure it covered me from aerial surveillance as well. Sure shooting, the administrator's devices would be on the prowl. I made sure everything was as secure as I could make it, then returned to Vert. Hugh was waiting for me and raised a coffee mug in salute. I fell back into my lazy boy with a loud sigh.
If it helps, I'm one segment away from you, Hugh said.
It does, a little, but let's face it, two of us isn't going to be that much more useful than one. We still can't take on the entire crew and resistance armies. We still can't travel in the water with Bender's Matrix, and it'll still take forever to go overland. I could hear the discouragement in my voice, but couldn't do anything about it.
Look, if nothing else, I still have my full complement of spiders and fleas, Hughes said. We might be able to rig something up. I'm about 6 days away from you, assuming I don't have to sit around waiting for a boat going in the right direction.
I nodded thoughtfully. You'll have to go halfway down the Arcadia before you can get on a connector to loop around to the Nirvana. That'll add to your time. I let the silence stretch for a few mils, then opened my mouth to bring up the whole AI thing, and predictably the rest of the expedition members picked that exact moment to start popping in. Howard was sitting in the video window with Bridget as well. "Where are we at, Bob?" Garfield said. "My Manny is in a grass nest with the crate. I put in extra effort to make sure it was concealed. I've reduced the Manny's body temperature in case someone uses infrared for searching. My one spider is out of the box, ready to lightsaber anyone or anything that gets too close."
"I don't think infrared is likely to be a useful tool," Bridget said. "The whole point of fur is to retain heat. Fur-bearing animals tend to shed heat, either through their breath or their feet."
"Feet?" Garfield said, disbelief in his voice. Bridget nodded.
"Hummingbirds would shed heat through their feet and eyes." She made a sad face. "I'd love to have seen a hummingbird."
"True of a lot of animals," Will replied. "We still have the genetic info from Svalbard. If we ever perfect the tech, we'll bring them back. You might yet get your wish." Bridget gave him a small smile of acknowledgement, then turned back to me. Anyway, the Manny puts out almost nothing when resting. You could float downstream, and you'd be almost impossible to spot. Leaving out the small question of Bender. Look, Bob, Hughes said, leaning forward, your problem has been basically lack of opportunity and time to implement some kind of solution for keeping the Matrix dry. And lack of money, I interjected. He grinned. Yeah, that too, but I have money. I've been crewing all the way and haven't had to spend anything, plus the money my Manny was initially stocked with. You've gone to ground, so other than maybe getting a little farther from the water, you can stay put until I get there, then we can figure something out. I nodded without comment, and again found my opinion of Hugh shifting. He seemed to be honestly concerned about getting Bender out of Heaven's River. If he was also interested in the AI issue, was that necessarily nefarious? Was I overreacting? Part of the problem was that I didn't want to find out. It was a true-to-form original Bob problem, a tendency to not want to deal with uncomfortable personal issues. I clearly had no replicative drift in that particular department. Hugh's suggestion about moving away from the water was a good one, and I made a point of doing so that night. Under cover of darkness, with my scent turned off, I hoisted the shipping crate and made my way uphill. I wanted a location where I could see around me but be camouflaged and where I had an escape route if someone approached. Eventually, I found a deadfall formed by several trees and their root balls, which created a natural kind of cave. Only one problem. It was occupied. Some kind of badger-like animal, with all the accompanying friendly behavior, rushed out and tried to bite me when I came too close. I tended to be a live-and-let-live kind of person, but I had been running for too long, and I was getting decidedly short-tempered about it. I reacted on instinct, the same kind of reflex you get if a dog lunges for your leg. I jumped back, and as the animal continued to charge, I hauled off and kicked it. "Yipe," said the badger as it sailed over the deadfall, and "Ow, fuck," said I, and "Oh, shit," said my internal monitors, or something to that effect. Bottom line, though, my kicking legs seized up. I gaped at the unusual and certainly unhealthy angle of my knee, then turned to the heavens and used every English, Pav, Quinlan, and Delton swear word that I had ever saved up for just such an occasion. I don't think any of the underbrush actually burst into flames, but it was a close thing. Eventually, when I found myself circling around into the third repetition, I let it wind down and began to hop my one-legged way into my new home. There were enough branches and sticks available.